Well, good evening, everybody. Welcome to Bible class and welcome to those listening online. Pretty exciting Ecclesiastes 3, which is what we're talking about tonight. So with that, we'll get Jeff to come forward and speak to us about Ecclesiastes chapter 3.
Good evening, everyone, and a sincere thank you for turning up at this very late hour, 8 o'clock, dear me. Well, we've reached a wonderful chapter in this this book about wisdom in Ecclesiastes, and I'm assuming that Solomon wrote the book. So, if I'm wrong on that, well, that's fine. But it seems like it is Solomon's book, and the wisdom is his. So, what we have to remember is that Solomon is on a journey here, and this is quite early in his journey. It's only chapter 3 of all the chapters in the book of Ecclesiastes. So he is progressing in his understanding of what wisdom is all about. So seeking wisdom and filling our God-shaped hole. There's going to be a little bit more about that as we progress. So we have a big question to start with. Now, I'd like you to just think back on earlier days in your life and ask the question, who has embarked seriously on a search for meaning during your life? Okay, we've got a show of hands if you can identify with that. Yep, it's something that some people very, very consciously are engaged in. They want to know what life is about. And Solomon was one of those who embarked on a search for meaning. And our search for meaning is going to come in at a number of different levels. We can have a shore-based search for meaning, which means we remain within our comfort zone. We don't necessarily embark on a journey which is going to take us away from where we feel comfortable. Or we might have a dinghy sailing comfort zone where we're prepared to leave the shore and go out, and maybe there are some islands that we can see out there, and we sail out to those islands to just find out what's going on out there, to find out a little bit more about what the world is all about. Or we might be offshore sailors, where we are prepared to go beyond that horizon which we can see out there. We've got no idea what's out there. But in our thinking, we are prepared to embark on a journey into the unknown. And that can be a dangerous journey, can't it? So when we have a search for meaning, sometimes that journey can be very, very dangerous. And there are great minds that have pondered the meaning to life. And four of them who came up with a similar notion are Augustine, Blaise Pascal, C.S. Lewis and Sue Catchlove. It was pretty frightening about 50 years ago when Sue embarked on her search for a God-shaped hole. And she used exactly those terms without knowing that Pascal or Augustine or C.S. Lewis had already coined the terms. But in a paraphrase, each of those people have said there is a God-shaped vacuum in the heart of every man that cannot be filled by any created being but by God alone made known through Jesus Christ. Now that is a pretty big step in thinking, isn't it? Is that shore-based, dinghy sailing, or offshore to actually launch into that sort of direction? So is there anyone who'd like to talk about your search for meaning and the God-shaped hole which we're going to be exploring?
I always just been travelling with the fine God and the patients, and travelling a lot. Not that I was focused on God all the time and the moment of that, but I had situations where I met people in the church, and things like that. few years, I suppose, I went to Europe and around Australia and New Zealand. And when I came back to Adelaide, that's where I fell.
Right, Joe has just outlined that his search for meaning involved travel around the world. He went right around the world and found that there was something, a God-shaped hole could be filled here in Adelaide. So that's an interesting one. Sue, tell us about yours.
I think even as a little girl, I always believed in God. I didn't quite know. Well, I did know it very well. Said this story before, recently in a bungalow with probably knocked out the front. As I got older, I mean, I had dragged at Christianity, Billy Graham Crusades and the church, and then life was so exciting I left it all behind for a while. And then it started to niggle, just niggle. In fact, I married Jeff, still didn't fill the hole. Travelled, still didn't fill the hole. Lived elsewhere, still didn't fill the hole. I just knew had to be something deeper and far more meaningful than what the world has to offer.
Thanks, Sue. So for those who are listening, Peg and Tom and others who are listening, Sue has just outlined that ever since she was a little girl, she believed in God, and she knew where he lived. He lived in a bungalow with hollyhocks out the front. And throughout her life, she found that nothing seemed to satisfy this yearning which she had. And so she called it a God-shaped hole 50-odd years ago, and that frightened the daylights out of me, because it was very obvious that I wasn't able to fill that hole at all, and Sue had to find it. So the story went on from there. Okay, so let's move on. What is going on? Okay. Well, Solomon had a similar spiritual dilemma, and it was born out of frustration with life's futility, which you'll remember in chapters 1 and 2, he talked about vanity of vanities. It didn't take him long to work out that life was pretty futile. And he diagnosed the problem as being a God-shaped hole, not that he used those terms, but he had a God-shaped hole which he needed to fill. So, this is not working. Not at all. Okay. All right. Anyway, Solomon then proceeds to build a case for filling the God-shaped hole, and it's a hole-in-the-heart operation that he's going to engage in. So in Ecclesiastes 3, we have a look, first of all, at the scope of what we'll have a look at tonight. I mentioned earlier that in Ecclesiastes 1 and 2, he realises that because studies don't satisfy and pleasures of life don't satisfy, nor does his work and business. I mean, he was a very busy man as a king, wasn't he? A great king. And it wasn't enough. It was still a vain activity that he was involved in. And in verse 24 of chapter 2 of Ecclesiastes, he says, "A person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their own toil. This too, I see, is from the hand of God. But happiness was not found in that." And so his search went on. So in this chapter, he contemplates, first of all, changeability in life overall. He looks at the contrast between human affairs and God's affairs, and he finds that God's life, God's ways are changeless. So the changeability of man is contrasted with God's changeless ways. And he discovers in verses 16 and 17 the vanity of worldly honour and power. And isn't this what so many people search for in their lives? They want promotion, or they want to have a lofty position in society. They go to university to study so that they can be successful. And Solomon finds and expresses in verses 16 and 17 that it is a vain exercise if we are seeking full happiness. He also looks at man's condition, and then finally in the last verse he pins it down to how we find peace under the sun at this point in his search. So verses 1 to 10, we won't read through all those, but it's that wonderful section about time. For everything, there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven. And Keith and Jan reminded me before we started this evening of the birds singing that song. What's the title of the song?
Turn, turn, turn
is the title of the song, and it's actually Ecclesiastes 3, verses 2 to 8, right down to the very word. So there is a time for everything. And now what we're going to do is just have a look at a number of these things in relation to those verses, which are about the changeability of human affairs, the life and times of a human being. It is a normal life that is being depicted here. And verse 1 says, for everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven. Now, the word matter apparently means delight. So here we have an offer being made to us to delight in every matter under heaven. Every matter in our lives, every matter that you've been engaged in today is an opportunity to enjoy delight. Solomon implies that by fitting into a given matter or event of God at the right time, we can experience delight as well. And this is living in the context of enormous change in society and in change in our lives. Our lives are constantly ebbing and flowing, waxing and waning. We've all experienced that, and I'm sure that you'd all have something that would come readily to mind about what types of change you've experienced in your lives. Maybe we could sample a couple of those things. What are you experiencing now in the form of change? Right, okay, thanks, Joe. Sorry?
Retirement.
Okay, so Jan's retiring in about a week's time. That's going to be an interesting...
Same for me too.
Same for... there we are. It's going to affect Keith as well. And both will have to adapt to each other and also to a new life of flexibility. Right, any other experiences of change that you're going through right now?
Teenagers.
Okay. That's a wonderful challenge, and the children will enjoy it immensely. Okay, so world of change is multi-dimensional, isn't it? We live in a world of change, and every change concerning us is unalterably fixed and determined by a supreme power. God knows about these changes. He's been there before. So what's happened here is that something funny happened there, Ben. I don't know what it is. Okay, so the point that Solomon is making is enjoy yourself because change is a part of life. Some of us hate change, don't we? I don't want anything to change. And, you know, we think about ecclesial life, and that's always a bone of contention, isn't it? When something comes up that's going to change the order of this or that or what we do here or where, wherever. And so that has to be worked through. But it's just reality. Okay. Now, what we get is a sample of 28 life experiences, and some are purely acts of God, and others are the will of man. So we start off with there is a time to be born and a time to die. And we have a look at the possibilities of what that implies. It's very obvious that every one of us has been born, but there's that downside as well, that every one of us is going to die unless the Lord Jesus Christ returns first. In Ecclesiastes 9:5, for instance, the living know that they will die, but the dead in Christ rise first. So this doesn't just apply to human beings, does it? What else does it apply to? Every living thing. So it's not unique to our experience, but across the globe, They're a generation after generation of all living things. A time to plant and a time to pluck up. And those of you who are mad gardening fans would know all about time to plant and time to pluck up, and all of the elements of a successful growing process for any plant. You need the right time of the year, you need the right soil, there's a time to plant. But when would you pluck up, for instance? When would you pluck up something that has been planted? Harvesting, and also otherwise, other reasons? When it dies or when it's diseased, right? There's a time to pluck up. And so we make earthly things come and go, but when you think about the fact that they are going to die, then there's a degree of vanity. It sustains us while it's alive, but it will then die, and we can say, well, there you are, there's vanity. There's a time to kill or suffer, and all of us have experienced suffering, without killing, of course. And we know that throughout history there have been judgments of God where killing has occurred. We understand the reasons for that. I hate it, but that's exactly what has happened. Huge armies, huge masses of people have died as a part of God's plan and purpose. But when we think about the healing side of it, we are thinking about the really positive, optimistic side of God's mercy. And there's a time to break down and a time to build up. During history, particularly Israel's history, there have been kingdoms coming and going, and they have fallen away, but then they've been built up. And we know that this is so often the way that, and even ecclesially, you know, there are cycles where, not that we break down, but there are cycles where there's a dip in the enthusiasm of everybody, for whatever reason. But there's also a time to build up. And hopefully we can be on the upward end of that curve so that we can assist in being positive. Now, I'm not going to spend a huge amount of time on this, but we've got that scope again, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones. And some examples of this, the casting away stones, would be where fortifications have been broken down, where a garden or a vineyard has been destroyed, and one of the reasons is all the rocks and all the rubble which is around the place, which don't give the plants a chance to grow. And so they are going to be moved out of the way, and gathering stones together for the building of walls or fortresses or strongholds are a process of getting going again. And so often here we have examples of things that have set us back, but then the next time for or time to builds us up again. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. And that one is common sense, isn't it? We know that embracing somebody can be the wrong move, and we can refrain from embracing when it's inappropriate to do so. There is a time to seek and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, time to fear, tear rather, I'm sorry, a time to tear garments in mourning, for instance, as a ritual, a time to tear nations apart, God knows about that, a time to for wrong to have been undone, and a time to sew. We're talking about garments here, but the principle applies to human activity as well. Time to tear garments, but a time to make garments. It's a time also, if there is a breakdown, a tearing down of a structure in Israel's history, there is also a time to be reconciled or sewn together. Then we go on to a time to keep silence and a time to speak, time to love and a time to hate. But look what we finish on. We finish with a time to war, but lastly, a time to make peace. And that is the optimistic side of the mission and the quest that Solomon has to find the meaning to life. So a summary of those verses, a time for every matter or every delight, is that some things are purely acts of God. We don't have any control over them. But others are the will of man. Sometimes we wreck our own lives, don't we? And we need to be aware of the role that we play in the directions that our lives take. Those illustrations are also proof that God knows about all our life experiences. I don't think there are any exceptions in that listing that we have, and that there is nothing new under the sun. We can identify with all of those things that we've just had a look at. Verse 9 in chapter 3 goes on to look at how God controls history. And we come to a rhetorical query, really, in verses 9 and 10. He says, Solomon says, what gain has the worker from his toil? Now, that's not a bad question, is it? What exactly do we gain? Well, we have things like livelihood. What else do we gain from the work that we do? Again, sorry.
Satisfaction.
Lisa, I'm sorry.
Satisfaction.
Satisfaction, certainly. Yep. Satisfaction in doing a good job, Andy?
Fitness, exercise.
Yep, good. Okay. The question is, what satisfaction do we gain from our work? Food. Yeah, you get sustained, don't you, by making a living. Okay, so Solomon goes on to say, I've seen the business that God has given to the children of men to be busy with. So it's a very practical point that is being made. But according to Malcolm Fraser, who was poo-pooed for saying many years ago that life wasn't meant to be easy, there is nothing truer under the sun than that life was not meant to be easy. In spite of every endeavour that we make in our lives, there is bound to be varying degrees of sorrow in whatever happens. Sometimes it just comes out of nowhere. We have no part in causing it, but it affects us terribly. So there is nothing new under the sun. God has allotted us not only good things in our lives, but he's also allotted to us the challenge of dealing with toil and trouble. I guess it's all tied up to the curse way, way back, isn't it? So what do we say to ourselves? Why should I work hard when it's all going to be vain, when it's going to be destroyed in the end? Why get married when you can just end up fighting and hurting one another? Well, that's a pretty pessimistic view, isn't it? And it's not necessarily realistic at the same time. Why have a child and deal with the stress and disappointment of teenagers? Well, they're all good questions, and these are the questions which are running through Solomon's mind. I've got a question. Verse 9. What gain has the worker from his toil? Well, God gives us that realisation that we can understand what lies beyond this time. This is what Solomon is seeking. He's looking for that God-shaped hole. What is there beyond all this obvious stuff which I'm coming across? Our life experience is not only to give us happiness, but for our faith to be exercised by those experiences. Now, this is a really, really important point that Solomon's making. Even the actor Jim Carrey said this. He said, I think everybody should get rich and famous and do everything they ever dreamed of so they can see that it's not the answer. Now, that's pretty powerful statement, isn't it? Particularly from a fellow like Jim Carrey. Oh, dear. Why doesn't this work? Here we go. Chapter 3, verse 10. Solomon continues with this statement. He says, I've seen the task which God has given the sons of men, with which they occupy themselves. We question why? Some more than others. Some question, why was I born this way? Why aren't I as smart as they are? Why did my father treat me that way? Why is this happening to me and nobody else? It's all happening to me. The point is that God, in fact, does his bit. He makes everything happen in its proper time. And even those things which have afflicted us and which do afflict us, God knows, and Solomon knows that God knows. But what can we change out of all of that which adds meaning to life? Anyone relate to that? Anyone like to comment on it? Okay, so our challenge in all those circumstances when we're asking these questions, why about me, our challenge is to understand God's purpose and his presence in our lives so that we can handle it. We focus our attention quite often on the wrong thing. Having a look at things from God's viewpoint is rather different from looking at it from our viewpoint. We see the fuzzy, ugly cocoon in the garden, but God plans and sets in motion the butterfly, that beautiful butterfly that emerges from the cocoon. We see and experience the painful, awful process of these things that are happening to us, but God knows the value of the experience in the long term. We see today, God sees and knows eternity. We don't know that, do we? We don't know what eternity's like. If only we could imagine it, maybe we would respond differently to some things. We see the wrapping, God focuses on the gift. And finally, we see the natural, but God, of course, sees the spiritual. So if we can shift ourselves into the right-hand column a little bit more, maybe we'll be able to handle these things which happen to us. Can we see things through God's lens? So key point number one, human experiences over time can offer purpose and happiness in spite of the negative implications sometimes. Verses 11 to 15, we look, and Solomon looks at God's changeless ways. We'll especially look at verse 11 because that is the key to the book, key to the whole book of Ecclesiastes. God has made everything beautiful in its time, Solomon writes. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart. The God-shaped hole. There we have the answer. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. So we have that as a touchstone for this section. Solomon continues. He says, God makes everything beautiful in its time, and nothing is omitted from that. He sees our loss, our hospital experience, our failures, our brokenness, our battles, all those negative things that we experience in life can be beautiful, and the three words, in its time. Right now, it's really hard, but in its time, it can be made beautiful. So can we trust God? This is what Solomon is asking. Can we trust God in the wisdom which he's offering to us? He knows that without God, life is vanity. Can we trust also that with God, life has purpose and ultimately everything will make sense? And can we trust that through God's lens, every experience becomes beautiful in its time? Do you find that encouraging? Is that an encouraging viewpoint? It's so important, isn't it, for us to go into God's realm, into God's mind, to understand things from his point of view, and it will help us immensely, particularly when things negative affect us. So the key verse that we come to is the turning point, God has set eternity in their heart. And presto, there's the purpose. There's the point. The God-shaped hole is filled by knowing that God puts eternity in our hearts. And remember that question we started with? What is the meaning of life? What a simple answer this is. An unbelievably simple answer, which everyone on earth is capable of understanding. It's a very beautiful thing. And so we can ask that question, as Solomon was, are we closer to an answer? Filling the God-shaped hole. Okay, so eternity in our hearts, we've just spoken about, is what we can understand from this section of verse 11, where God has set eternity in their heart. That is, able to fill the God-shaped hole. Answering the question, what is the meaning to life? Answering it slightly more. So, verse 11, the latter part of it says, but even so, people cannot see or fathom the whole scope of God's work from beginning to end. That's perfectly obvious, isn't it? But God has surrounded us with the whole world of creatures and nature showing his wisdom and power and his goodness. And so there's no excuse, is there? The works of God can be so grand that they never can be grasped. Some get it, but some don't. And thinking about all the damage which occurs across the globe and which has always happened, where people carelessly treat creation, carelessly treat each other, obviously most people don't get it. You think about terrible wars and crime and all of those horrible aspects of human existence, and a lot of people don't get it. They don't get the wisdom or the power or the goodness of God. So a key point number two is that God has set eternity in our heart and he will fill the God-shaped hole that we have. Let's move on to verses 12 and 13. I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives. So we haven't reached the ultimate answer to filling that God-shaped hole. But I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labour. It is the gift of God. So that's wonderfully encouraging, isn't it? There's no law against those things. God actually wants us to rejoice. He wants us to enjoy our meals together, because meals and fellowship are so important together. He wants us to enjoy our work, because it gives satisfaction, it gives us the income, it gives us an opportunity to express the talents that we have. And he wants us to rejoice and enjoy his works as well, because they are a level far, far above our level. They are eternal. And so we can see what God gives us in those regards as a wonderful gift. And in Corinthians, Paul identifies with that. He says, therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labour is not in vain. So that's encouraging too. It did puzzle me years and years ago about this vanity thing. You know, why should we bother going to work? Why not just hang around and wait for everything to happen? That would be a total abuse of the goodness that God has shown to us. But at least I was thinking about it, even if it was the wrong thought. So in practice, we show every man these things. The fact that God has provided us with food and work and revealed to us his wonderful works. We can show every man, because it's not just for us. It can benefit everyone, can't it? And this, of course, is talking about an opportunity to proclaim the gospel to other people, so that it's not just contained within our own lives. We understand our labour is the gift of God, and so we can enjoy it. So Solomon is expressing his appreciation for all the things that God has done for us, and he's also identifying that our life is just a probation. It's an opportunity to do these things to show that we understand and relate to him and his ways. So the third key point is that our joy through biblical faith is an antidote to the pressures that we experience in life. When we talk about a time for something negative and then a time for something positive, we can say, yeah, life has got lots and lots of pressures. There's a time for pressures, but there's also a time to enjoy the riches that God is providing for us. So we come to verse 14, and the theme now is about fearing God at the same time. I know that everything God does will remain forever. There is nothing to add to it. There's nothing to take from it. For God has so worked that men should fear him. Now, here we've got an immovable object. God is an immovable object, isn't he? And God has made it that way so that men should fear him. But when we look at that word fear, it's not a terror that we have of God. There are a couple of reasons why that word is used. Morally, it can be to reverence God, and in another sense, it can be such as would make us afraid. We are daunted by the power that God has at hand. So, using any of those expressions for fear, why do we fear him? Well, look at his creation and what natural disasters are happening right at the moment. In the news, flood, yep, earthquakes, earthquake in Israel, I believe, we were told the other night. What else?
Volcanoes,
yep. That power of God is just astounding. It's beyond comprehension. And so that's a good reason to fear God. And look at his actions. Look at the way prophecy has been fulfilled throughout time. And God's actions in sustaining creation, sustaining human beings for 6,000 years, sustaining and allowing how many species of plant and how many species of fish and how many species of insect to continue time and time and time again, century after century after century. They are God's actions. He has created those things. This is the power that we're talking about, and this is the justification for fearing God in a very positive sense. So his power and his actions are unmatched in every way. And so with that appreciation, it's a very good reason for us to believe and trust and commit to the living God. So verse 15, we're nearly there, and God requires an account of what is past. So verse 15 we read, that which is has already been. Is that true? Whatever is in his creation now has already been. And what is to be has already been, the future. It's happened before, and God requires an account of what is past. So the common refrain that we hear probably from every generation is the good old days. Things were always better in my day. Surely the world has never been as bad as it is now. Or if only we had a change of government, then wouldn't that help things? Just not like those good old days when we had good government. So history repeats itself. We know that, don't we? And mankind is changing. That's the bird's song about turn, turn, turn. Mankind is forever in a state of flux. Nothing is new to God. He knows history. He cares about people who have suffered in the past. He controls events and people. And God judges the heart of man. So man needs to account for himself because God knows. And so this point of fearing God, we are to revere him, and his changelessness leads man to fear before him. History repeats itself, but God still holds man to account, no matter what. Okay, now we come to a really, really topical part of this chapter, verses 16 to 22, where Solomon explores, and remember who he is, he's the king. He explores the vanity of worldly honour and power. There is no one more powerful on the earth than Solomon at this point of time. What about the judges of the time and the clerics of the time and the polis, the politicians? And what about today, the judges of today and the clerics of today, the ministers, the priests and the politicians? And Solomon is very conscious of his own position as king when he says there is a problem of injustice here. And a paraphrase of this same verse says, "And I discovered something else in the world. In the place where judges make judgments, they make wicked decisions. In that place where we expect fair decisions, the judges are not fair." Well, let's explore what that means. He knew that judges can be corrupt. There are plenty of judges on earth at the moment who are corrupt. There are some countries which have no control whatever over the jurisdiction and the judges of the time and the country. They expect money for favours. Nothing new about that. We know all about that, don't we? And justice was meted out according to wealth and not righteousness. Graft and corruption, bit of sheesh, and we'll be able to arrange whatever decision you would like. And today we have big business affecting the government's decisions about, you know, who can do what and who can't do what. So levels of innocence vary greatly between the rich and the poor. Quite often the poor are the victims, aren't they? And in places of war, of course, oftentimes the biggest casualty listing is amongst citizens and not the competing armies. So there's heaps of corruption and injustice, and he's frustrated. Solomon is frustrated by this. It seems that wicked people will win and good and righteous people will lose. That seems to be the case, doesn't it? There's plenty in the Proverbs about this, but I really enjoy what Solomon has to say about it. Men have their day now, but God's day is coming. Can we get our heads around that? We might just have to wait for true justice to come about. And we need to have a fear of God and a respect for him so that it gives us meaning for life and a clear conscience on what we do with our lives. Otherwise, we're going to join all those who are living a life of vanity. So what about the wicked? Verse 17, Solomon said in his heart, "God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, because there is a time for every purpose and every work." God knows every human contingency. He knows what's going on. That's something that slips from my mind too much. We need to know that God knows every human contingency. And we need to know that the judge in the law courts, the clerics, the politicians will themselves be judged. And with an eye of faith, the pride and the cruelty of oppressors will end. That is a promise. In Psalm 92, verse 7, "Though the wicked spring up like grass and all evildoers flourish, they will be destroyed forever. But the Lord laughs at the wicked, for he knows their day of coming is coming. Truly you set them in slippery places. You make them fall to ruin. Therefore do not throw away your confidence. You need to endure, and my righteous one shall live by faith." That's the promise in Hebrews. So we have a reassurance. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. Psalm 73, verse 26. And the whole of Psalm 73 is a withering attack on the wicked. So it's worth having a look at that. So the fifth key point is that God has his time and work of judgment and overrules what now seems dark. So let's have a look at man's condition. We'll take it a little further. Verse 18. I said in my heart, concerning the condition of the sons of men, God tests them that they may see that they themselves are like animals. As one dies, so dies the other. All is vanity. All return to the dust. Who knows the spirit of the sons of men? So, sons of men, they are like animals. Let's have a look at why he says this. Can we believe that? Can we believe that Solomon would say, we are like the animals? Well, people have no advantage over animals. And Solomon realised that there was no difference, ultimately, in the life and destiny between humans and animals. God is testing our common sense and reason to respond to what he is saying here. How many consider and accept this? So, back to the big question. What is the meaning of life? In the light of the fact that man has no advantage over animals. Most people live as if we're here forever, and this alone is a good reason to set our affection on things above. Now, I have to say that it didn't sort of enter my head consciously for about 60 years that there is an end to life. I don't know what your experience has been, but when my body started falling to bits, I realised that maybe there is an end to this life, and maybe it's coming up. But this is a really, really sobering point, isn't it? That man has no advantage over the animals. As one dies, so does the other. So let's have a look at some other common practical observations along these same lines. First of all, we know that when the flood came, the beasts weren't saved and mankind wasn't saved. They all went. The flood swept them away. Horses and men killed in battle, the same weapons of war, they all go down. All of us have one breath, animals alike, and all of us breathe the same air. So we've got lots in common, but one dies and so dies the other. We all turn to dust, animal and human being alike. And so a commentator, Dean, wrote this about it. He said, the distinction between man and beast is annulled by death. The former's boasted superiority, his power of conceiving and planning, his greatness, his skill, strength, cunning, all come under the category of vanity, as they cannot ward off the inevitable blow. Very powerful, isn't it? So two verses to go. Verse 21, who knows the spirit of the sons of men which goes upward and the spirit of the animal which goes down to the earth? Well, man must acknowledge our nature. We must acknowledge our nature and our mortality to proceed to the next level of wisdom. That's the point. The point is we have to accept our nature and mortality and what God requires for us to proceed to the next level of wisdom. And that demands of us humility and an acknowledgement of God's righteousness above our own. And some of the characters in the Bible have done that. Adam offered the lambskin. Abel made the correct offering. Noah was humbled by the flood and responded to God's call. Abraham was prepared to sacrifice his son. And so Solomon concludes that the proud, those of us who are proud, are as beasts, like roaring lions, raging bears, like horses and mules. Beasts perish, and so do we. And so given that backdrop of what our life is about, he says, honour God and be humble, vilified and mortified by God's presence. Fear him in those ways. Otherwise, we are no better than the beasts. Proverbs 15 verse 24 says, the chosen path of life leads upward for the wise, that he may keep away from the place of the dead below. And so all of us want to be involved in that way. So in taking stock, do we really want to be limited to the status of animals? And the answer is no. So finally, finding peace under the sun, some versions say under heaven, finding peace under the sun, verse 22 says, so I realised, what is the best thing for a person? What is the best thing for a person? At this point in his reasoning, there are nine other chapters to go, aren't there? He must enjoy his work, because to enjoy his life is God's gift. God has given us the gift to do the things that we can do according to the talents that we have. Nobody can know what will happen in the future. So, God's gift, meaning to life and enjoyment are found in a clear conscience, doing the right thing. And I don't know about you, but if I do the wrong thing, my conscience is really, really seared. I know. In fact, I go red even when I'm not guilty. But when I am guilty, I'm double the colour, I suppose. I don't know. It is. So a clear conscience is really important. Having a cheerful life, not a melancholy, downcast life. Obviously, we're going to go through those emotions, but not be dominated by them. If God has prospered our work, let's rejoice in it. At this point in Solomon's reflections, we know what he expects of us, but we also have a big question mark about what lies ahead. So we can be content knowing that God opens his hand to satisfy the desire of every living thing. So let's keep life simple and godly and honest. That is the best we can do at this point. So, our search for meaning has those key points. Human experiences can offer purpose and happiness. That's your workplace. That's your family life. That's your ecclesial life. They can offer purpose and happiness. But we know that God has set eternity in our heart. He can fill the God-shaped hole for us. We know that biblical faith is a call to joy, like the first point there. Human experiences can offer purpose and happiness. Biblical faith is a call to joy. And we need to revere God because he is changeless and all-powerful. And God has his time and work of judgment ahead. So let's take stock and do what we really want to be limited, or we don't want to be limited to the status of animals, and we do want to be regarded as members of God's family as an alternative to that. So keep life simple, godly and honest. And so finally, in seeking wisdom, in our own ways, we are all searching for meaning throughout our lives. And it's really important for our children and our families to understand that there is an answer in that search for meaning. But in the meantime, our search is acted out in our behaviour. We do have a God-shaped hole, and who fills the God-shaped hole? God. God fills the God-shaped hole and all of his characteristics, love, joy, peace, all the fruit of the Spirit, all those wonderful things that we're taught. So humanity's problem is that it attempts to fill the God-shaped hole with things other than God. Would you agree with that? It's very true, isn't it? But Jeremiah reminds us that the heart is deceitful above all things and beyond cure. And so only through a personal relationship with God and faith in Jesus Christ can the God-shaped hole be filled.